Today on Maine Calling, brainwashing, mind control, and hyper-persuasion. We hear the word brainwashing a lot these days. It's come up during testimony in the Sean Diddy Combs trial. Public health advocates talk about brainwashing in terms of the anti-vaccine movement. The word is used when referencing American schools, religious cults, the Taliban, Putin in Ukraine, social media, the list goes on and on. But what is brainwashing anyway? Where'd the term come from? And who is susceptible? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, our guest is the author of the new book, The Instability of Truth, Brainwashing, Mind Control, and Hyperpersuasion. She examines the history of these concepts and what they mean in today's world of hyperpartisanship, artificial intelligence, and the internet. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Have you been brainwashed? If you say no, how can you be sure? My guest today, Rebecca Lemov, is the author and professor of a new book called The Instability of Truth, Brainwashing, Mind Control, and Hyperpersuasion. She is a professor of the history of science at Harvard. Rebecca, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thanks so much, Jennifer. It's wonderful to be here.
We invite you to join the conversation. Do you see things happening around you that feel like mind control or brainwashing in action? Do you believe that it has happened to you? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Rebecca, it's so interesting because the news cycle is just full of the word brainwashing or brainwash. I see that it's being used. One of the witnesses in the Sean P. Diddy Combs trial has said that he was brainwashed. I saw an article about Taliban fighters being brainwashed and turning against their mom. I saw that Marjorie Taylor Greene has accused PBS and NPR of brainwashing children. And it seems to me as though this word is used a lot. And that's something you found out. It the use of it is on the rise, isn't it?
Yeah, I did discover. I mean, I started studying this topic about 25 years ago, oddly enough, when I had just finished my dissertation. And it was such a odd topic. Nobody understood why I was interested in it. And they would say, you know, why would you, you know, doesn't this have to do with the, you know, forgotten Cold War or some sort of, it seemed kind of cartoonish and unserious, just even to pay too much attention to. But if you take something like Google Ngram and you just graph the use of the word in publications over the last couple of decades, it really rises spectacularly to the moment we're in today, where it's come back into, I like to think of it as coming back into the realm of seriousness.
What does the word mean anyway, when somebody says brainwash? Interesting history of the word, correct?
Yeah, very interesting. I find it interesting, and it keeps me coming back to it. I think that if it were as simple as just a dictionary definition or a Wikipedia page and you could put brainwashing to rest, there would be no need to write a book or spend so much time going into archives, listening to oral histories. But what I found interesting is how did the word enter the English language? What has been its adventures? What can it mean? What does it really mean in our lives? And I find it to be a kind of tricky word, because it refers to a tricky reality, which is that we don't always see it. It's one of those things that's kind of hidden in plain sight. It's not straightforward. And so a good definition, a kind of working definition I use, is a synonym or a phrase, coercive persuasion. So it's not just, so coercion would be just the sheer use of force or torture to make somebody comply. But this is coercion. There often is an element of torture or force, but mixed with persuasion and kind of a buy-in with the participant. It's a dynamic that often is really complex.
By that definition, many of the ways it's used today don't fit, right?
I mean, it can be used as an insult, a slur, and a politically motivated term. So, I mean, I think that we can observe that happening. But what I like to use it for is a window of inquiry. So we can all ask ourselves, it's better to ask yourself some about the dynamics of brainwashing than to maybe identify it elsewhere. I think it's more helpful.
A big part of your book looks at the history, and just I'm going to ask you about a couple sort of moments in U.S. history in which brainwashing was really an important part of the cultural understanding of what was happening. And the first is with Korean War prisoners of war, and this is really when this whole concept of brainwashing was first widely used and started to be understood. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I'd love to. Because the Korean War, often for a long time, it was known as the Forgotten War, and then even that name was forgotten. So, in the time of the Korean War, it really became most famous for the what were called the brainwashed troops, or this crisis of brainwashing. And this is hard to underestimate the power of this kind of national emergency that occurred when many first 59 US pilots appeared having confessed to having dropped biological weapons over Korea and China during their flights. And these were false confessions that had been extracted under conditions that were not well understood because the pilots, in some cases kept confessing, or they kept being convinced that this is something they had done, or they had been used for propaganda. But after the pilots, it seemed that many returning POWs were also showing signs of ideological confusion or conversion. So they had written letters home talking about the, sort of using the jargon of communism. They had seemed to be embracing their captors instead of their own country. And then in the crisis peaked when 21 US soldiers refused repatriation and elected to go to China instead because they were disenchanted with capitalism and the greed of their own society. And they had been held in these camps for several years. And so I wanted to know what had happened to them.
Yeah, and this is when you said the great crisis and people. It's interesting to me because what I learned from your book, Rebecca, is though even though on some level people started to understand that these people had been what we call today brainwashed, there was still a lot of anger, a lot of these people were not embraced. They were not treated kindly. They were treated as though there was some sort of fault with them. There was something wrong with them for having been brainwashed.
This is true. Sometimes troops would return, and the only thing their neighbors or family members would know was that they had somehow been compromised and this new mysterious super weapon had been used against them. But this didn't cause people to be necessarily compassionate. They were seen as uniquely weak or uniquely susceptible, these young men, and that maybe. So there's one story that I learned in an oral history of Korean War veterans, and this soldier talked about how he came home. He went to a bar with his uncle in the town he was from, and I think it was Indiana, and he said something like, "I'm just returned from the war." And the bartender said, "Oh, you're one of those brainwashed fools," something like that. And the POW said, "I never spoke of it again for 30 years." He never mentioned the war again. And it was so shameful and so internalized, the sense that they had been associated with a dishonor. When you go back into the stories and what they went through, the incredible suffering, really just suffering on a level I have hardly ever seen. And even compared to World War II, they were dying at far greater rates. The POWs were dying, the soldiers were dying as well. And in certain battles. So this part was kind of erased, and they were just seen as these kind of freakish cowards often.
And what these captors were doing was very intentional, right? It wasn't just because these men had been through so much that they began to have what is often referred to as Stockholm syndrome or something. It was there was a program and there was a way in which they were being indoctrinated and being brainwashed.
That's exactly right. What I discovered, and this emerged over years and talking to China scholars who understood that actually the brainwashing was much more Maoist than anyone had ever known, and even that Chairman Mao actually wanted to conduct an experiment on these captive men who were sort of conveniently sitting in camps for many years. So it's important to know that the Chinese did not have control of the POW camps until the last year or two of the war before the armistice. So before then, they were run by the Korean military, and the conditions were extremely bleak. Men were dying of starvation overnight, sometimes just from having to walk outside to, say, relieve themselves in the middle of the night. They would just simply die from malnutrition, exhaustion, and despair. And sometimes when their compatriots would go to bury them on the top of the hill, they too would die just from, they were so weak. I mean, they often lost half of their body weight just in getting to the camps. And then, there was fraying of social fabric. There were all sorts of things they had endured. And then when the Chinese came, the food did get better. The conditions got physically better to some degree, although it was still not great. But then this new formal program of re-education was imposed, and this was also called thought reform. And basically, these men were extraordinarily went through the same thing that Chinese peasants were put through in the Chinese revolution, in the communist revolution, to kind of convert them to becoming proper citizens. And it didn't work on everyone, but it worked to some degree on many of the troops. And really, what they went through was a systematic program some of it was psychological. Like they were all given journals, which I think is extraordinary. Some of them came back with these journals that they'd been given, and they had to write about their family life, their feelings about their country, their feelings about their parents. And these were very young men, and who'd never none of them had been through therapy or any kind of psychological, processes. One of them, Morris Wills, who I write about, says he'd never even in school been asked to defend democracy. He didn't know how to talk about his own nation's governing structure. So when he was asked to defend it, he didn't know what to do. And he started, he did have criticisms by that time. He did feel abandoned by his own country. He'd been left for 3 years by then, starting at the age of, I think he was 17 when he enlisted. He'd almost starved to death. He'd seen people, he'd people had died overnight while lying next to him in the huts. They had to wake up in the morning and pour the blood out of their boots. They had been completely unprepared for this experience. So he felt abandoned, to say the least. And he started to, the minute he, showed some sort of positive response or started to confess these doubts, they would give you a little more food, or they would give you an hour in a warm hut because everyone was freezing. And so over time, he came to think that maybe there was something more just in this other system. And he said later in his memoir, once he returned to the United States after living for China in a dec for a decade, he said, "People think brainwashing is some magical wand that was, some kind of magical technique, but it was actually a slow, grinding, brutal process by which you come to believe something else." And it ended up not being permanent. So that's another interesting part of it.
That is interesting. Another case that also was not permanent but was really captured the attention of the country was the Patty Hearst case. So interesting to me, Rebecca, because I knew a little bit about it, but it happened during my childhood. So, of course, I, like many people, remember the images of Patty Hearst in the bank with the gun, and I think I had
heard this narrative that she was sort of a spoiled heiress who was on some sort of glamorous spree. But what you found out was, and what you write about, is very, very different, and how she indeed was the victim of brainwashing that had a lot of similarities to what happened to these Korean, the POWs during the Korean War.
Yeah, I think that was a common narrative. Even today, you know, there are plenty of podcasts and documentaries that come out describing Patty Hearst's experience as a wild ride, or this, you know, that as if she somehow had masterminded or enjoyed this experience, when what happened was this incredibly brutal experience of rape, abduction, and forced re-education, really much along the lines of what the POWs experienced. And I would agree with that analysis. And it's probably no surprise that the very same four top experts who had been brought in to understand what had happened to the POWs and the pilots, these military psychiatrists and a sociologist, then came back for Patty Hearst's trial after having, many of them worked for the CIA in between, and they came back for Patty Hearst's trial to try to make the case that she just kind of, they re-entered the public eye to argue that she had been brainwashed. But again, there was not really a ready audience for that argument.
That's right. Again, the public was resistant to that idea that somebody had been brainwashed. It's so, and again, she was not treated kindly, to say the least.
Right. She was held in a closet. So she was a 19-year-old sophomore art history major at UC Berkeley who came from this famous family, the Hearst family, about whom Citizen Kane was made. That was her grandfather. So, but she was one of five daughters, I think five children, and she happened to be at UC Berkeley with her fiance, who had been her math teacher. That's another story. And one night in 1974, she was abducted from her apartment. They beat her boyfriend over the head with a wine bottle. They shoved her. This revolutionary group called the Symbionese Liberation Army performed what they called a righteous arrest of this heiress. And they, you know, they shoved her in the trunk of their car. They sprayed the street in Berkeley with bullets from their machine guns, and then took off and locked her, basically held her in darkness for 59 days. She could never even go to the bathroom alone. She was blindfolded. They read the Chairman Mao's writings to her in the dark over and over again, because some of the followers were these very doctrinaire guerrilla, you know, they saw themselves as in a guerrilla army. They told her they were just one small group of a vast organization that was all over the United States. They said she would, you know, they basically said, they said that she should have sex with various members just to show her goodwill. And they were, interestingly, they said, we just want to make sure you're not brainwashed. We want to make, because the press kept saying, it sounds like she's been brainwashed, because she was forced to make these tapes, cassette tapes, that were then sent to the local radio stations. And in the first tapes, she sounds really shaky. She says, Mom, Dad, I'm okay, but please do whatever they want. And initially it was to give groceries to people all over California, which they did. And then after a while, she gets more and more strident in her delivery. And she, at a certain point, a couple of later in the stay in the closet, she says, I now announce that I have a new revolutionary identity. You can call me Tanya. And Patty is dead. So she sort of seemed to have transformed. And this caused people to lose sympathy with her. She soon appeared. Well, I should say that once, there was a moment when they asked her if she wanted to join the group, and she said she had to make a decision, and she knew that if she refused, they would kill her. They had already assassinated several people. And so she said, I didn't just have to agree, I had to actually become a soldier in their army. So she has this line where she says, I accommodated my thoughts to coincide with theirs. She says that in her, I think she might have said that to Larry King at some point later. But basically, this was the mystery. Like, did she secretly want to join them all along? Because she soon appeared in a bank robbery. This is the image that you were talking about, Jennifer, is where she appears with this machine gun, and she's wearing a trench coat, and she kind of became a folk hero to some, you know, people. She looked like she'd really been revolutionized. She was moving around the bank. She didn't shoot the gun or anything, but she ended up being the only person who was tried for that crime.
I wanted to ask you, Rebecca, about this idea of brainwashing and mind control and hyper-persuasion today, when we have obviously artificial intelligence and social media and such fracturing in our society. However, we do need to go to a break, so we'll talk about that after the break. Do you have questions for Rebecca Lemov, who is the author of The Instability of Truth? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're learning about the history of brainwashing and what it says about society and about how humans think. My guest, Rebecca Lemov, who is professor of the history of science at Harvard University. She has written a new book called The Instability of Truth: Brainwashing, Mind Control, and Hyperpersuasion. We invite you to join the conversation. Send us a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Rebecca, we talked about Korean War POWs. We talked about Patty Hearst. You give many other examples in your book. One thing many of these cases have in common is what today we call trauma, a history of trauma. And do you believe that that is necessary, that some sort of trauma has to have been endured for someone to be susceptible to brainwashing?
I do think so. And I think that's a thread that made my research start to make sense is really, I mean, at one point, I think, so I had started to write this book many years ago, and then I put it aside for about a decade. I did other things, and I came back to it about 5 years ago, but I noticed, in all this early research, the word trauma never appeared. And think about what these people had gone through in the Korean War, and also even in MK Ultra, but that's another section of the book. But even with Patty Hearst, it was rarely mentioned that she was traumatized, even though the jury actually toured the closets where she was held. They just said, well, it couldn't have been rape because that was her boyfriend, and she had a couple of boyfriends, or there were ways that her suffering was somehow made invisible, and the element of trauma was not really recognized or understood. And you could say, well, that's because there was just an inadequate understanding of trauma at the time. And in fact, I have a friend who was trained as a psychiatrist in the 70s, and he was telling me we were trained really to say that to understand that trauma is so rare, like maybe just a person who's been burned, you know, suffered terrible burns over most of their body, you could say they were traumatized, or a war a veteran. But these were war veterans, and yet still it was unidentified. They were, as we were talking about, they were seen as just having been feeble or weak or stupid to fall for something. And we see this, so today we seem to live in a very different moment where trauma is everywhere. We have many new sophisticated definitions of complex trauma, generational trauma, even trauma that gets passed on epigenetically perhaps, or things like that. So maybe we've overcompensated, but I actually think that the trauma piece is still extremely important and often misunderstood, especially how it operates within our relationship to technology and to social media, and even to these emerging AI entities that are coming online.
Well, let's talk about that in terms of some of the examples I gave at the beginning of the program. We are talking about, Taliban fighters, and there are those who believe that they are being brainwashed to even act against their own family's self-interest, their own family, their own mother, I read an article that says that Putin is systematically brainwashing people in parts of Ukraine. And you can understand how trauma might play a role in both of those situations. But what about when we're looking at people who, you know, I read an article where there are public health officials who believe people who are caught up in the anti-vaccine movement are being brainwashed. Is that an appropriate use of the term? And how does, if so, how does trauma fit into that?
Well, I think there are many uses of the term, and certainly people can apply it very widely, and you can evaluate that as a reader. So, but what I find it most useful to use as a kind of investigation or almost a thought experiment for oneself. So, I mean, really the setup is to use these examples from the past that are very extreme, and then to ask each of us to apply them to seemingly trivial, low stakes situations that we all find ourselves in constantly throughout the day. Like, do I click on this or that? You know, what if I'm allowing these YouTube voices to, you know, populate my world for an hour? How is that affecting me? So it's, I think that trauma plays a role just in the sense I'm defining trauma as kind of unprocessed, intense emotions that we all have up to some degree. So I do use a very broad definition, but I think that what I've discovered is through, you could look at the history of social media research, such as the Facebook experiment of the 2010s, in which mass emotional contagion was deliberately operationalized through this particular experiment. And it's been actually shown that it's not that people come to believe things intellectually or rationally. It's not a defect of cognition that social media acts upon, but really it's an emotional contagion that can be mobilized. And I think we are more vulnerable to it to the extent that we each have, and I don't exempt myself from it. We each have areas of, you know, perhaps vulnerability, unprocessed. I mean, you can actually see this in the great book, the great classic by Robert J. Lifton, he's almost 100 now, but he was one of the first psychiatrists to analyze the Korean veterans and several Americans and Chinese intellectuals who'd been brainwashed. And he said, you could see their guilt complexes. You know, there was a young woman missionary who was held by the Chinese, and these things that had from her deep childhood then kind of cropped up again when she was placed in these highly pressured situations. So we can see that each of us has, you know, issues, whatever you want to call it, conflicts that can be mobilized, and we should. And therefore, you can be aware, you can try to be more aware of that and understand how that's operating, and not simply think of brainwashing as a bypassing of rationality.
What are some signs we all may think of to understand whether or not we have been brainwashed?
I look at my own experiences and think about this a lot. So let's see. I think understanding the history is helpful, understanding that everyone is vulnerable. I also look at the history of cults. So, understanding that one of the signs is to think that you're inured to it and that it only happens to other people. So I actually have this, you know, I think we all probably have, we live in a moment when cults are of great fascination, and there's a whole slew of cult documentaries, a new one every week, and they are fascinating. And sometimes they even kind of capitalize on or maybe exploit the kind of extremity of cults and the strange, bizarre things that happen in them. There's also a great interest in scams and the kinds of elaborate stories people fall for, and the humiliations of falling for those stories. And you hear about a new scam, and I think often the listener or reader thinks, at what point would I have broken off, or I wouldn't have believed that was an FBI agent. I never would have worn that, you know, that dress. I never would have given away my savings, or, you know, I'm safe from that. And so I think a lot of our preoccupations function to make us think we're safe. So I guess one thing is to reflect on, you know, if you do find yourself thinking that it doesn't affect you, it only affects other people. I mean, that can be an occasion for investigating, just really, I think as you're interacting with technology, to very much pay attention to how you're responding, even at the level of your body, you know.
So if you're responding emotionally and you're feeling it in your body, that may be a red flag that you need to be approaching it differently.
Definitely. It doesn't mean you have to. There's not one cure, or you know, we all have to quit completely or things like that, but just to be aware in an ongoing way of destabilization. And that's why I call the book The Instability of Truth. It's partly just we're living in a very unstable environment. And just to be aware of how that is affecting us as much as possible at every moment.
I want you referred to a few minutes ago a Facebook experiment. Tell me about that and what they found.
So this experiment ran in 2012, and it was published in 2014 in a prominent scientific journal. And it was one of the only times that the Facebook research team who ran this experiment tried publishing very prominently. And in fact, as part of the user agreement, we all agreed to be subject to A/B testing, which is really just to constantly experiment with the experience the user will have, you know, whether it's like the speed and the way the algorithm plays out. But at any rate, in 2012, Facebook did a very deliberate experiment where they set aside 693,000 users without informing them, and they altered the algorithm of the news feed. So this is the order with which the stories appear in one's feed when you would go onto your Facebook account, and the different types of stories that would appear. And they altered the feed so that it was measurably more negative for one in an emotional sense. So they would quantify the emotional quality of each post, and then they would alter the post towards negativity in one set of users. Then in another set, they altered that feed towards positivity, emotionally speaking. And then in a third set, they used as a control. And then they looked at the resultant posts. So how do people respond when their feed was altered and the algorithm was changed? The negatively altered group, in turn, the more negatively their feed was altered, the more negative became their posts and their responses, as measured by the same software. Likewise, the positively altered group also became more positive in their responses, although to a slightly lesser degree. And the control group was unaltered in its responses. So the conclusion was that that emotional contagion at scale, so across a vast population, had been achieved and operationalized. And this was sort of there was a bit of pride and almost a bragging air in this. That's what I discern in the scientific paper. And there's also a reference to the literature of emotion, of psychology, and the measuring of emotion. And so that came out in 2014. It caused a huge ethical discussion. Many, many protests. There were even Facebook users who wrote on the research team's Facebook page things like, "How can I know? Is there any way to know if I was part of that experiment? I was hospitalized during that time for suicidal feelings, and
Oh
I
dear.
struggled with depression my whole life, and I feel like maybe I was affected, and I can I ever know?" And of course, they could never know. And some of those responses then disappeared. And there are several investigations were opened about the ethics of doing this. One was in the UK, but none of these ever really came to fruition. And everyone in the experiment was ultimately, who ran it, was promoted to better jobs. There were several university professors who were involved, and they just ended up getting bigger jobs doing social media studies of various types. So, but one of the outcomes also was that Facebook didn't, it ceased publishing. I even ran into a data scientist recently when I was giving a talk, and he said, "Oh, I worked at Facebook for a couple of months last summer." And it's true, they don't publish on these types of delicate topics anymore. That proved to be for them a negative, just for people to be so aware they were being experimented on.
So these ideas of emotional contagion, it's not a very large jump to mind control from there. I want to tell you that I'm talking with Rebecca Lemoff. She's the author of a new book called The Instability of Truth, Brainwashing, Mind Control, and Hyper-Persuasion. We'll get to some of your calls when we come back from a break, including Peter from Bath. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, brainwashing and mind control. With me, Rebecca Lemoff, who is a Harvard University professor and the author of the new book, The Instability of Truth. If you're quick, you can share your comments and questions. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Peter, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me. And hello, Rebecca. I spent 17 years in a group that was started off as just doing Kundalini yoga and morphed into a cult. So I had some pretty deep experience in what it's like to be in a cult and the kind of people that get involved. And then I became, after I left there just a few years ago, I got trained as a trauma recovery coach and learned a whole lot about Balbi's work with attachment disorders. And then I did some informal research with members, former members of the same yoga cult. What I found out is that most of the people who got involved had an insecure attachment style, which had led to an insecure sense of identity. So they're easily influenced by the promise of a sense of identity that was secure and noble and worthwhile. And I'm wondering, I would love to see somebody actually do this research. It goes beyond what we normally think of as trauma and get into childhood traumas that are basically invisible because they often happen before the child is cognizant. Things like having an alcoholic brother or, fighting in the home or things that make the child feel insecure as an infant or as a young child. And I'm wondering if, Rebecca, if you have any insights into that would validate that perspective.
No, thank you so much for those insights. And I think there has been some research recently on connecting attachment style with susceptibility to cultic abuse, though I suppose it's possible, and I don't know that this research is determinative, that the other styles are also not vulnerable, but the research you, I mean, I think using your own experience to then learn to gain insight about what had happened and how you got drawn in and then how other people might, and becoming a counselor is really wonderful response. I have talked to many former cult members who find it such a difficult experience to leave these groups because not only did they often have horrible experiences in the end, I mean, sometimes giving over decades of their lives. And also one member I met at an International Cultic Studies Association meeting, he said that he described it as a dark hamster wheel of the soul that you ended up being stuck in, this kind of repetition, sleeplessness, giving over your financial, your life resources to these groups. But initially there's often a experience of ecstasy, union, a real sense of belonging that could be missing in people's lives. There's such an epidemic of loneliness today, not to mention a lot of childhood, even they could seem like small or maybe be invisible to the person, insecurities that can then be capitalized on by groups that are very skilled at doing that. So that's a really great point.
Yeah, and you talk about the epidemic of loneliness. I'm also thinking about all the people who are just looking for meaning, Rebecca. I mean, boy, that's possibly most people.
One of the truths about people who enter cults is they're often extremely idealistic. They tend to be, anyone is vulnerable. This is what I want to say. Nobody's invulnerable, but there are certain moments in your life, times in your life when you may be more vulnerable. And cults will actually appeal to the best parts of your nature as well as some of the wounded parts. So these can be extremely sensitive, wonderful people who want something better, who think that this promises something better, and who are initially experiencing, wonderful feelings of connection, of belonging, of rituals and closeness and, you know, these, as Peter mentioned, Kundalini yoga is a powerful technique, and it's not necessarily used for abuse, but it can be deployed to that purpose.
Peter, thank you so much for taking the time to call. Yeah, and for the good work that you're doing now. I appreciate that. We have an email here from David. Can the guest describe the difference between brainwashing and indoctrination? Rebecca, is there a difference?
Well, I think they cover some of the same territory they have. I mean, brainwashing is not really a scientific term, although it has been used by scientists and experts. So that I would say one distinction between the two is that indoctrination is more of a neutral term, and brainwashing has a lot of, it actually in itself has a lot of emotion, or it packs an emotional punch, and that's kind of what drew me to it. But it has some similarities in the sense that the outcome of brainwashing often appears to be indoctrination or ideological conversion. One of the funny things about the Patty Hearst trial, just to go back to that for a minute, is the lead defense expert was Louis Jolly on West, who is often called Jolly. And one of the first things he was asked to do when he was called to the stand to defend her was to define brainwashing. And he said, well, actually, I can't define brainwashing. There are many other words for it. It's not actually a scientific term, which is most unfortunate for Patricia Hearst, because it was hard to win a trial.
The jury heard it as him casting doubt on his whole field of study.
He was just trying to be honest. I mean, in a sense, he was also so, he was quite egotistical. They had just mentioned, you know, he was the head of the Neuropsychiatric Institute at UCLA, and he just was the great expert. So he just wanted to get into all the subtleties about it. He very well knew the power of combining hypnosis, sometimes putting people in drug-addled states and sleeplessness, which often are part of these processes. But he said just brainwashing itself has kind of a scandalous sense, and in that sense, it's not a perfectly scientific word. But I find it interesting for that reason. Indoctrination is really a component of what most people mean when they talk about brainwashing.
We'll go to Maggie calling from York Beach. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask the question, when somebody wants to brainwash a bunch of people, they may have people in the larger area or population that believe what they believe. And I'm just going to use this example of Donald Trump saying the election was stolen, and this keeps going on and on and on to the point where people started actually believing that. Also, I was so interested in the last two calls about cults because, you know, it's something that people think they're going to help themselves to do this, but they get indoctrinated, or you're using that term, or they are also influenced by the people in the cult or whatever to brainwash them. So I think that the most probably effective brainwasher is somebody who has troops out there recruiting people, either spreading a lie and bringing people into this frame of thought. And I don't know. Sometimes I just think to myself, what's wrong with these people? Can't they think?
Oh, boy, Maggie, no, so much there. And having just read Rebecca's book, it's so much there. But you saying what's wrong with these people, that's a really common reaction, right, Rebecca? But also this concept of people who are recruiters or influencers, that this is actually a strategy in either what you want to call it, mind control, indoctrination, finding people that can influence others more effectively, maybe not in a mass way, but in a appealing to certain groups.
Yes, this is a great question, Maggie, and many insights in there. I mean, this is one reason I coined the term hyper persuasion to talk about this process. And I think the media angle of brainwashing is really important, and it runs alongside the whole history, not just POWs, but actually the history of advertising, the history of persuasive techniques, and what was called in the middle of the 20th century mass persuasion. And actually, I originally was writing a whole chapter on influencers, social media influencers, which is certainly a part of the story, but that'll probably be the next book. It's very fascinating. But just to go back to what I think distinguishes our current moment and the power of what's happening, what we're seeing, is not so much that people have changed or become stupider or lost the ability to think necessarily, but that if you go back to the mid-20th century with mass persuasion, the original study was done by Robert K. Merton of a war bond drive during World War II. And during that, so CBS Radio made what we all know now on PBS as, what is it called? A fundraiser, where she went on the radio. So instead of on television, she went on the radio. She was a very popular singer at the time, and she didn't go
Kate
off.
Kate Smith, right? I'm sorry.
Kate yeah. Smith, right. Yeah. Thank you. She didn't go off for 48 hours, and she was so beloved that people said they forgot, they couldn't leave the room until she stopped talking to them because they were so worried about her. They talked about selling their wedding rings. They talked about, you know, feeling this, the power of her message. And this was a historic event. They raised more money by many times more than had ever been raised before, just as a result of this war bond drive. So Merton talked about mass persuasion and the techniques that had been used to galvanize people in a profound way. And he said they were almost rendered helpless by this series of messages and the way it was delivered over the mass media at the time. But in the moment we live in today, it's not just a mass message where everyone is receiving the same broadcast from CBS Radio. It's that each of us receives a very different set of messages. Even in the Facebook experiment, there's a different order in which your own Facebook feed, your news feed, is different from anybody else's. And not only that, but political. Merton had said we could sell soap this way. We could sell a political candidate in 1942. But now we have these highly individualized messages. And that's why I think about hyper persuasion. You may not even have a record of what was shown to you. You probably don't have a record that's different from the campaign message that was shown to somebody else based on their psychological typology, or maybe some information you gave online or some digital trail, so that messages can be highly customized. Influence can be spread throughout a system without necessarily being traceable. And so we do live in a really unstable situation where hyper-persuasion can take hold. And therefore, I think what I found useful is to examine not just, you know, other people are losing, are succumbing, but we are all involved in this process.
It's not just, I think I saw an article that came out recently. Have you noticed that it's only people who disagree with you who are brainwashed?
Exactly. That's exactly this. It is so tempting, but it cannot be true, right? We're all being exposed. It's just we tend to be more blind to our own, the things that reinforce our own cognitive predilections.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Rebecca, but it sounds to me that if there's one piece of advice you'd give us after doing these years, decades of research into this topic, whether it's full-on brainwashing or also having your thoughts influenced by a very, very calculated social media feed or algorithm, that we all need to do a gut check whenever we find ourselves feeling emotional about something that is coming at us from somebody else, and stop that, and stop that emotional reaction, and instead try to be rational and try to understand what's happening.
That's a great way to put it. I mean, I would actually say also a gut check is not so much to stop it, but to examine it. What am I feeling at this moment? Especially disgust. That can be a real sign that you've been triggered by some series of messages and, you know, just something to look at and to be aware of, and maybe not to immediately react, but to try to use it as it's almost an opportunity to see the way you have been pulled in by something. And that that dynamic, whether it's of polarization or separation or enmity, is part of what we're all experiencing. I go back to this. I mean, what really inspired me was actually Aldous Huxley, my favorite writer. He wrote in one of his more obscure books about, he talked about the quasi-hypnotic trance in which all, not all human beings, but most human beings spend most of our time. And he said, I mean, what I thought was interesting is, how can we understand that quasi-hypnotic trance better so that we can potentially find those moments of balance, you know?
And your next book may be about influencers, so that'll be really interesting. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us for the hour on Maine Calling. I know you've got a lot of people who want to interview you about this book. Rebecca Lemov, a professor of history of science at Harvard University and the author of the new book, The Instability of Truth, Brainwashing, Mind Control, and Hyperpersuasion. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Maine's role in the abolition movement. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.